Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning, Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. Now, crime in the city. We've heard about the impressive drop in crime from Mayor Dinkins, then Mayor Giuliani, and now Mayor Bloomberg. An 80% drop in crime over two decades certainly does sound good, but how impressive is our decline in crime really? Well, my next guest has taken a hard look at the crime stats and thinks New York City actually does have a lot to teach other cities about how to reduce urban crime. Just might prove that violent crime is not an inevitable part of American city life. He is Professor Franklin Zimring, and his new book is called The City That Became Safe, New York's Lessons for Urban Crime and Its Control. He teaches at the UC Berkeley Bolt School of Law. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, you say that length and decline in crime here are unprecedented. Is that decline real? What are the stats?
Okay. First of all, the statistics are Guinness Book of World Records, if I can advertise a little bit on public radio. Homicide is down in 19 years by 82%. The robbery rate is down by 84%. The burglary rate is down by 85%. Auto theft is 6% now in New York. Of what it was in 1990. It ought to be on an endangered species list. That kind of more than four-fifths drop is something that's never happened in a confirmed way statistically in a large American city that hasn't changed in huge ways.
Has it ever happened in New York's history? I mean, you know.
No.
1800s?
No.
Never, never, never. Never was a decline?
Never, never, never when we were counting carefully. The problem with the 1800s is that you've got an awful lot of oral history there. And I think that the statistics that I just gave you are pretty reliable, and that's the big difference. Now, that's also not an obvious point. Because we have a peculiar sort of political economy in crime statistics, and that is that the people that keep the official records, the police department, are also interested parties. This is a little bit like the coach of your little league team also being the umpire. But what our study did was to use independent measures of some of those huge crime drops. It turns out that the health department also does a good job on homicides. Are their data the same as the cops? Yes. It turns out that insurance companies also keep track of auto thefts. Have their auto theft claims dropped like a stone? Yes. And the timing and magnitude of New York's crime statistics of the drop, that isn't to say that that the police are in any sense perfect, but it is to say that when you independently measure robbery and burglary and auto theft and homicide, you've had more than an 80% drop, and that is absolutely astonishing.
And has it shown up in every single neighborhood in the city?
Yes. It has to, but it doesn't show up equally. That is to say, if you're living in a rich neighborhood and I'm living in a poor neighborhood, and we both have 85% drops, and mine in the poor neighborhood is going to be much bigger because I had much more violent crime to begin with. But that is a kind of a drop which is so pervasive that it has to happen everywhere, but it is most concentrated in the areas that were most threatened by crime.
Now, these kind of declines were happening all over the country. So was this just because every city was copying each other in terms of their techniques, or was there something sociological happening at the end of the last century and the beginning of this one? What is the why here?
Well, there you have to divide the era into two. During the 1990s, crime dropped everywhere in the United States. But it stopped dropping for about 8 years, right at the turn of the century. And with regard to that great American crime decline, which was about 40%, it wasn't sociological, but it was completely mysterious. No single central answer for the national decline in the 1990s holds much water, and we published a study about that 4 or 5 years ago. But what makes New York special is that New York's crime drop was twice as long. It was from 1990 to 2009 and may be continuing even now. And it was also twice as big. And the thing that's interesting about that is that while we can't, that same mysterious 40% drop that happened in the rest of the country isn't easier to explain in New York. So about half of New York's crime difference, we can't really explain. But what's different about New York is the twice as much and the twice as long. And there, almost by a process of elimination, in four of the five boroughs, and the only one I exclude is Manhattan, the only big changes were in police and policing. So for the New York difference, we can come much closer to a persuasive explanation than we can with that whole of the 82% crime drop. I wish I could explain the whole 82%. But what I think happens is that when you look at what rather small changes contributed huge amounts of prevention in New York City.
When you say small changes, you mean small changes in policing?
I mean, you had at peak an extra 7,400 police in a city.
Right, but now you don't. Now the police department in New York City is much smaller, shrinking.
Now the city's police department is bigger than it is in 1990, but 4,000 of those 7,000 odd police are gone. So what you've had is you've had the same population, you have some of the same institutional problems, you've made relatively superficial changes in three kinds of policing. You've got more cops now, and you still have more cops than you had. They're much more aggressive, and that has real costs too. And they're using different strategic approaches, and that's important. But for it to have a tremendous change in the crime rate, to prevent that much crime, actually means we have to rethink what we thought about crime. 20 years ago, Andrea, we didn't think that police could make much of a dent in violent crime. And that wasn't because of our theory of police being ineffective. That was our theory of crime. The idea is very simple. Cops can't be everywhere, and they can't stay forever. So what we thought is, you send the cops on Tuesday night to 125th and 7th Avenue, and the robbers will just go to 140th Street. Or if you send the cops on Tuesday, the robbers will wait till Thursday. Well, it turns out that high-rate criminals aren't that persistent. And what turns out to happen is that if you prevent a robbery on Tuesday night on 125th Street, that's one less robbery in New York. So that, in a sense, the effectiveness of the police are showing us not only were we wrong about what cops could do, but we were making assumptions about the persistence of criminals that have to be wrong, or New York didn't happen. It turns out that crime is, if I can use a couple of buzzwords, a little bit more situational and contingent. And if I don't do it today, then I may not do it.
All right, let's take some calls. We've got a number of people calling in. Bob from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on WNYC.
Oh, hello, Andrea.
Hi.
Hi there,
you're on the air.
Professor. Yeah, I was on hold, so I might have missed part of your comments. But you said there's more effective police procedures, I guess, in the past 10 or 20 years. I would point out, I was just a civilian clerical employee of the police department many years ago. I worked in a high-crime area in Brooklyn, and I helped keep all the crime statistics, and I saw everything. I worked on weekends and at nights. I saw the unbelievable out-of-control crime there was in those days. But I would say probably the most effective thing in New York City was the police arresting people for the quality-of-life crimes. You get the troublemakers off the streets because that's the people most likely to commit more serious crimes. But my main point is, I don't know if you mentioned this CompStat program, which was credited to Mayor Giuliani and Commissioner Bratton. A lot of people are crediting this better keeping of statistics, allegedly using computers, and then putting the police manpower where the crime was. That was always the case. In the 1970s, the police department kept meticulous, accurate, detailed crime statistics. They knew the type of crime, the location in every precinct and every sector. Every precinct is divided into sectors. They knew where the crime was by sector, the time, the type of crime. They always kept great statistics. They had computers even in those days. There's something called the CCD, civilian, I forgot to call it, the CCD, the complaint desk. They kept the statistics every four times a day. They would call up the precinct, the police headquarters, the communications department would call up the precinct. The statistics were called in over the phone. It went right into the computer, also from 9/11, and also the arrest crime coding section. They kept statistics within 24 hours. The borough knew, police headquarters knew, the precinct knew, and they put the police, most of the manpower went to where the crime was. They also had the tactical patrol force,
Bob?
And all of this. So this is all a myth about Giuliani.
So you feel like this was being done beforehand?
It was always done. They had task force.
Frank, let's get Frank Zimring to respond to that. Frank Zimring, professor of law at UC Berkeley, has written a book, The City Became Safe. What do you think about what Bob is saying, that these statistics were always kept?
Okay. There always was a sensitivity to data in the New York City Police Department, and there were very important strides made in creating information. But what CompStat did bring, and I think that William Bratton does deserve a fair amount of credit for bringing it, was two things. One was that the police department's ability to centrally administer and control the police department got a lot better under CompStat. There were fiefdoms and local control situations in previous police administrations that really tried to frustrate statistical efforts to get a handle on things. And centralized control, which is in many ways the opposite of community policing, was one of the things that came in the 1990s with the new manpower and with a much more focused control on hotspots, on going where crime was most persistent.
Professor Zimring, I'm wondering sort of what, you know, we haven't addressed the issue of at what cost. You know, we've done a lot of stories on WNYC about the police department's very aggressive stop and frisk policy, which has had a disparate impact on poor minority youth. There's a great feeling of resentment that, you know, has come up in certain minority communities about the police. There was just this emergence last week of this Facebook page where police officers were apparently calling the residents of Central Brooklyn savages. So is there a sort of underbelly to all of this?
There may very well be. And that is to say that if you were to take the three changes in policing that I use as a slogan here, you had more cops, you had different strategies, and you also had vastly more aggressive policing. And There are two things that I want to say about the more aggressive style of policing. One, it does have enormous costs, and we're not sure that it adds value to the crime prevention. We know that the way in which hotspots was done by the New York Police Department was quite effective, and we also know that it was quite aggressive. There are 700,000 stops and frisks. The number of misdemeanor arrests, and I want to talk a little bit about what those arrests are and aren't, has doubled in New York City, even as the number of felonies and felony arrests have fallen by more than half. Okay, now is this quality of life law enforcement? No, it isn't. And that is to say, there are a lot of arrests for minor crimes, but these are arrests to take Jack Maple, the strategist who created this. They're out there trying to arrest sharks, not dolphins, Jack Maple said. These are ways in which the police use order maintenance crimes as an excuse to get people who look like robbers and burglars to them off the streets and find out if they have warrants
so
for their arrest.
Are you saying that that is or is not an effective strategy?
I'm saying we don't know whether you need all that stopping and frisking to produce the effectiveness that the hotspot emphasis has had.
All right, let's.
You can't know from the New York City data. It may be effective, but we're not going to be able to test that. And the problem is, because it has enormous social and emotional costs, it's an open question which festers.
All right, let's take at least one more caller. Jean, hi, you're on the air on WNYC.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to make an observation that I haven't heard come up in this discussion, which is that one of the things that has changed over the last decades is that Manhattan, certainly, and even parts of Brooklyn have become the domains of the rich and affluent, more so than they were in previous times. And the policing, there may be something relevant to the changes in policing that occurred at the same time. And by the way, I think the use of the term aggressive is kind of polite in describing police behavior in this period. It's more abusive, I would say, than aggressive. Point that is at the center of policing and has been from the origins of the police in the 19th century has become also more emphasized, and that is protecting the property of the rich.
All right, let's get a response to that. Frank Zingman, what does the incredible rise in wealth in parts of Manhattan and Brooklyn have to do with this?
Okay, well, Manhattan did have two social changes and economic changes that have to be controlled and that the study does control. In Manhattan between 1990 and 2009, the number of African Americans resident in Manhattan went down 29%, and they were essentially priced out of the borough. And per capita income, which was always hugely higher in Manhattan, went up tremendously, controlled for inflation about 21%. So you have to deduct a lot of the changes, including crime changes, that happened in Manhattan. But four-fifths of the city's population lives in the other boroughs. And there, the demography, the concentration of minorities actually went up in places like the Bronx and Queens and was stable in Brooklyn. And incomes in Brooklyn, not in Park Slope, but in Brooklyn, population 2.4 million, did not have these kinds of Manhattan increases. So the way, for instance, that we measured the effectiveness of police was to subtract two things from the New York pattern.
All right.
To use the median non-Manhattan borough change and to compare it to other cities. And when you do that, you've controlled for the social and economic change, and you still have a huge crime drop.
All right, Professor Zimmering, in about 30 seconds, we have not seen a decline in drug use. Is that right? And yet there's been a big drop in drug-related crime. How do you explain that phenomenon?
Well, drug violence. What happened was that the police destroyed public drug markets. If you and I are selling in a public drug market illegal drugs, we're going to fight over what the best corner is, and we end up shooting each other. If you're selling from your apartment and I'm selling from my apartment, the number of drugs sold and consumed doesn't go down, but the number of drug killings went down about 90%.
All right.
Now,
we have to end it there. I am so sorry, but we are out of time. It has been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank everybody who called. If we didn't get your call, the conversation will continue online. Click on the Brian Lehrer page on WNYC.org to continue talking about this. And Frank Zimmering, sorry we couldn't go longer, but we are out of time. Thank you so much. Frank Zimmering is a professor of law at UC Berkeley and the author of a book on New York City's precipitous drop in crime over the past years, the city that became safe, New York's lessons for urban crime and its control. Thanks so much. Thanks to everyone who called. And when we come back, reasons to love New York.